Welcome to Running on Purpose, a podcast dedicated to training the body, the mind, and the soul for what the race requires. My name is Steve, and I'm your host. So I'm glad to be back with you. And finally, I'm doing another solo episode. As I mentioned recently, I've been working on a new series for this podcast, and I'll be announcing that pretty soon. So this new series that I'm planning will fold in with the inner work dialogues that I've been doing with Kobe over at In The Zone. And I'll continue to post around the Endorphin Book Club, like what this episode is, and more on that below. And I'll also continue with reflections around training the body, the mind, and the soul as my inspiration ensues. So some of that is, you know, in the works. I have already some outlines on a few topics. Some of those topics are the felt sense or the feeling state, three intelligences, thinking about the head, the heart, and the gut, and the way that we make sense and we know as athletes. Some essential skills in attention and awareness, which is something I've been unpacking and thinking a lot about lately with my athletes. A deep dive into the various energy systems that I introduced on the Keep Going podcast with John Schrupp. And that's specifically episode 22, if you want to go back to the Keep Going podcast to see what that is. But with kind of a special focus on more of the esoteric aspects or the sort of inner experience of what's going on with those energy systems in relation to, you know, the feeling state, the felt sense, and a lot more topics. Now, I recently had some criticism from some folks, both for the podcast and for my coaching, around perhaps the potential that I'm a little too philosophical or that I've moved the direction away from really practical insights around training. And while I understand that and I feel disappointed in the fact that the response to some of this content might not be desirable for everybody. But, you know, that's just the way the cookie crumbles. And I really am planning for this specific project to be something that's more coming from my own heart and the space that I think is really important for athletes to consider and think about. I am highly focused on the practical applications around anything that I'm talking about on this podcast. I wouldn't talk about it if it was just airy-fairy, woo-woo, artsy-fartsy bullshit. If you perceive it as those things, I just ask you to potentially maybe open up a little bit and listen a little more closely. Maybe I'm not effective in delivering this kind of content in a way that is palpable for everyone. And I can work on that, and I will continue to work on it. But I'm not going to stop mining these hills. So this is the area of deepest interest to me. This is a free podcast. I give it away freely. I'm going to do what the fuck I want to. All right? Now, of course, you don't have to listen, or you can listen. This is a recurring theme now, but I'm just not going to approach it anymore or discuss that part anymore. I just think maybe what I do is just end up sounding defensive and upset. And yeah, I mean, I do take things seriously, so I take criticism seriously, but maybe I need to take it better. Regardless, here we are. This is where we find ourselves. But I will tell you, if you've got a topic that you'd like me to cover, then please feel free to reach out to me. You can do that at sisson@telosrunning.com. And I make a solemn promise that I will consider it. And I will reply to any emails that are sent to me from people regarding the Running on Purpose podcast. I get very few. So in a lot of ways, I feel like I'm just shouting out to the great online wilderness, but that's okay. But if you have something you want me to cover, I'd consider it. And, you know, you can expect me to bring my strange and unusual perspective to it. But yeah, I'm down for hearing what the people want. I'm willing to consider giving the people what they need, as you may have heard on another podcast. So today's episode has been long in the incubation, if it's been going to be a rather short in its execution. I announced the Endorphin Book Club in the season 2, episode 12, and I had about a dozen folks start reading the book that I'm going to be covering today in this episode, Peter Ralston's Art of Mastery. It was a bit of a rocky going as I was facilitating for the first time a book club. I'd never done it before, and I didn't really understand what a book club should be, and it also turns out that the nature of Ralston's book made the discussion initially pretty challenging. We had 4 meetings, and in those, we finally got through the book. And in our last 2 discussions were really fruitful. In fact, the first discussion was really, really fruitful as well. It took a little while to get going, but I thought, given the challenges we had with the ease of reading of Ralston's book and the depth of its content and insights, that we did pretty okay. However, our next book in the series, which we'll be voting on more on that in just a second, it will definitely be shorter, more in the 100 to 150 page range. All 3 of the books that we're considering are written in a very colloquial and easy to read manner, and they all have, almost all of them have an audiobook option. So those of you who are interested in listening to your reading material rather than reading it, you have that optionality if you want to participate in the book club. So again, if you're interested in joining the EBC, just let me know. And you can send me an email at the email address I just indicated. And I'll invite you to the club. Okay, the club's free. We'll meet 1 to 2 times a month, typically on a Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. Central Time. That seems to be the time that we're sort of honing in on. That way, it's a little bit still relatively early for the East Coast folks and still just after work is finishing for the West Coast folks. Those of you who are listening around the rest of the world, just if you're really, really interested in the EBC, the Endorphin Book Club, and you want to participate, then we can tweak the schedule a little bit to accommodate more if they're interested. But for now, these are the folks that have been showing up. So that's the date that we're going to do it. And then, you know, like I said, we meet 1 or 2 times a month and for about an hour or so, and we'll discuss a portion of the book that we're reading. So it's usually 2, 3, 4 chapters, depending on what is needed. And then we will end up the episode, we'll end up the book club with a final wrap-up meeting. And then I will have an episode just like this one, a book review of this particular book that we're reading. And if you're interested, we are currently voting for our next selection. We're doing that this week. And if you want to vote, be sure to reach out. You can reach me at sisson@telosrunning.com. Voting will be closing this Sunday evening, May 5th. But all 3 of these books, I think, again, will be really interesting to people. The 3 books that we're voting on are Shambhala by Choegum Trungpa, Open Focus Life by Les Femi, Susan Shore Femi, and Mark Beauregard, and Free Play by Stephen Nachmanovich. These are 3 excellent books. All 3 of these I highly, highly recommend. They're books I have read and reread, and I consider them foundational to a potential point of view where their concepts can be implemented and applied to running really, really well. If you want to look on the show notes, those books have links in their names that go to Amazon, and then you can read more about the books if you're interested in them and purchase them if that's the way you want to go. All these books are under $20. I think 2 of them are under $15. So they're relatively inexpensive. So just to remind everyone, the Endorphin Book Club shtick is that it's a book club for runners reading books, not specifically about running. And that's going to be the ongoing plan for it. My initial outlay of the Endorphin Book Club was around the potential of it becoming much bigger and maybe other people starting their own book clubs. That hasn't taken off. Maybe it will. Maybe it won't. I'm still open to it. But for now, this is the one book club that's in the Endorphin Book Club, and we would love for you to join us if you're interested. Again, it's free. You just reach out to me, and we'll get you set up. All right? So I want to jump into my Endorphin Book Club review of The Art of Mastery by Peter Ralston. Initial overview. If I've ever read a more complex book that uses conventional English language, I can't remember it. I read a lot on the subjects of philosophy, psychology, spirituality, and self-help, but rarely have I read a more challenging book written in what I call plain speak. It's not the language Ralston uses that's challenging. It's the concepts and the way he asks the reader to consider these concepts in really radical, non-intuitive, and non-traditional ways. Because of this, the book makes for some heavy sledding. Perhaps this is the reason our book club shed engaged readers over the 3 months that we wrestled with the text. But before you decide it's not for you, please hear me out. There are so many diamonds in this book for practical application, for challenging assumptions, habits, and even our conception of reality. But I think Ralston does so without relying on any philosophical language. And I think he keeps it really real. So in this episode, I'm going to cover the book's format, its core concept, and a few very practical takeaways that I believe will be helpful enhancing a runner's training and racing experience. Some of these are coming from our Endorphin Book Club discussions, and some of them are simply my personal points of resonance. I hope this review will be helpful to you in determining if you'd like to read further into this work, maybe other of Ralston's work, and potentially get excited and engaged with the idea that the Endorphin Book Club is considering. So who is Peter Ralston? Now, I found Peter Ralston's work over a dozen years ago as I was researching different approaches to body awareness and what you might call the inner experience of physical skill and mastery. Came across his book, Zen Body Being, which I devoured immediately. I loved the book so much that I recommended it incessantly. I bought copies for other people, loaned my copy out without an expectation of ever having it returned, and believe me, very rarely did get it returned. I think my Amazon purchase history says that I bought the book 5 different times. It seems like I might have done it even more so. But as I transitioned in my workspace from Rogue to Telos, I found that Ralston's approach to what we might call somatic skill began to permeate much more into my coaching work. I found myself using his principles in a variety of different contexts as I was thinking around the physical, the mental, and foundationally in some form of worldview exploration, which I have unpacked variously on the Running on Purpose podcast. He's also written a whole bunch of other work. He's written probably 5 or 6 other books. These are more philosophical works around what he calls consciousness work. And I found in those even more resonance and challenge. I found in them resonance and challenge because I'm so interested in philosophical, ontological, metaphysical, psychological constructs and how we consider what reality is and how the world actually works. I even considered taking an extended visit to his retreat center, which is outside of San Antonio near Bandera. But the amount of commitment that Ralston requires in terms of time away from my family and work and the cost of his retreats, which are not prohibitively expensive, but just the duration of them, how they expect you to be there for 3 months or 6 months, it's just impossible for me to consider being a coach and continuing to have work experience in those areas. So it was just too much for me to accept. So I continued reading and watching videos from his YouTube channel, which I've linked below if you want to see that. And if you watch these, you'll realize that he's a bit of a cantankerous fellow and relatively aloof. And eventually I kind of moved away from his consciousness work and I just settled in on focusing primarily on Zen body being. In the fall of 2023, The Art of Mastery came out and I pre-ordered it immediately. After receiving it, I read through the first chapter and decided maybe I'll try the audiobook because I found the book really exciting but also very challenging. I had a really hard time getting a clear grasp on the concepts. Because while I found them discussed in pretty simple and easy to understand language, the concepts were very challenging to my mindset. I kept realizing that I thought he was going a current one direction, and then it turns out really he was talking at a much more basic level. this level of foundational concepts or base concepts is really a hallmark of the book itself. One of the things that makes it really readable, but also makes it hard to get your arms around and to get a clear grasp of. So listening to the audiobook on long extended hikes on the trail helped a lot, but I still felt like I needed some kind of hook to help me get through the whole thing. Now, finally, over Thanksgiving, I was able to hunker down and read and listen to the whole thing, and I found it very profound, but also very overwhelming. And I recognized it would likely be very helpful if I had someone or someones to read it with, hence the Endorphin Book Club concept. Now, Ralston makes his living as a martial arts instructor and philosopher. His form of martial arts is not really founded in any one tradition or school. Instead, it's devised through the practical application of skills that he endeavored to learn himself while he was training under teachers. He had teachers for many, many years in Asia, East Asia, South Asia. And while he did have these teachers, Ralston also insists that he was very much self-taught, in the sense that he took the skills acquisition and conceptual frames that he learned from his instructors and from his teachers to task. He basically broke them down, deconstructed his experience and the experiences of others in order to learn the skills of agility, attention, grace, and power that are foundational to any martial art. But on top of it, he also found what we might call enlightenment, what one might call what he spends a great deal of time discussing in his other books, not The Art of Mastery or Zen Body Being, but in his other books like The Book of Unknowing. He talks a lot about consciousness, about awareness, about not knowing. Basically reconstructed so many concepts from his own direct experience. And The Art of Mastery is essentially all the gold and none of the bullshit that he considers essential to mastering any given domain. In many, many ways, this book is his life work distilled into just over 200 pages, which I think includes incredible wisdom and insights. So that's who Peter Ralston is in a nutshell. Again, as I said, if you want to find out more about him, he's got a YouTube channel. He's written a number of books, numerous books. And while he's not incredibly popular as a teacher in terms of reach, I think that his depth is something highly sought after, and he's someone who many people, it seems, have found great insights from. And that's what I found in this book. But what about the hubris of mastery? I mean, what even is mastery, and can it be attained? There's a lot of talk in business, life coaching, sports circles around the concept of mastery. There are hundreds of books, thousands of YouTube posts, and hundreds of thousands of seekers of mastery. But what even is it? Nearly all the experts will point out that mastery is really a process rather than a destination or an achievement. George Leonard, in his classic book, Mastery, tells us immediately that mastery is a process. It's a journey. And then he unpacks five master keys to help frame the discussion. Robert Greene, the current guru of mastery for the intellectual and financial elite, and author of, yeah, you guessed it, Mastery, also sees mastery as a process, and similarly has five key concepts that he thinks are essential to it. But these books, as good as they are, in my opinion, really just sketch the outlines of it. They ask the reader to find a particular master, to be an apprentice, someone to help them with mastery. And what they're helping them with is by being an example of mastery. And that's how they learn it. Now, Ralston definitely sees mastery as a process, and he continuously throughout the book reminds us how goals and outcomes tend to stymie our ability to develop mastery. He provides a detailed primer on the basics. He attempts to unpack principles that are required for attaining mastery instead of examples of great men and women exhibiting it. In our reading of the book, we regarded this as a significant challenge in understanding his concepts. But now I've reflected much more on the principles he draws forward, and I see that it's significantly more useful and practical to require the reader to begin to work with the concepts themselves, to move them from the theoretical and conceptual space into real life. Now, perhaps being an apprentice and seeing a master at work will help with this. But one of the challenges is that if the person seeking mastery is provided with too many practical examples, they might continue to conceptualize the principle. Instead of it being a concept, it would be an idealized example and not a lived direct experience. And this is the crux of the art of mastery. To be a master, you must have direct experience of the principles that it requires. Refine the idea and concept through the action of living the principle through your body. This is what I feel makes the book so powerful and resonant, especially in relationship to his Zen Body Being book. The direct experience of principle in action, and those are his words, the more action accords with principle, the greater understanding throughout our body and mind, and a higher likelihood that we become the principle. To achieve this direct experience of being a principle, it will require that we change our life. We must transform. And Ralston is adamant early on that anyone attempting mastery must realize and recognize there are significant habits and frames of mind that are not allowing us to become masters in our area of interest. And a willingness to change, to transform, is absolutely required. He mentions that few are really ready for the kind of surrender required to become a master. Now, to his credit, he doesn't harp on this, but I would. Now, I would argue anyone who chooses to consider living these principles in action will need to surrender their knowing, their habits, their mindsets, in effect, their whole life. And this is a huge ask. It's one of the reasons why I'm jaded by most people who mention that they want to master any activity or in any project, or that they're a master at something, if they even claim that. Have they surrendered to what it actually takes to begin to get on the road to mastery? Will they sacrifice everything in an attempt to develop the skill, grace, and acumen required? I mean, that's the toll. It's radical change. Now, before you call me a crank or an asshole and turn this episode off, I do think there are a great deal of insights and benefits to be gained from beginning to open to the mastery that Ralston is presenting here. Even if one doesn't want to pursue such radical change, the principles he brings forward are really helpful to consider. And you can begin playing with these in your day-to-day life, I think. There's a real strength to the book, in my opinion. We can simply unpack the principles as we're ready and able in our busy and complicated lives. So what are these principles? Yes, exactly. What of them? Before I go into some of Ralston's core principles, I think it's really important to cover what principles are in his understanding of mastery. In my opinion, so much hangs on the idea that these principles will help us achieve a mastery in our chosen field. But traditionally, we've been told that the key to getting better at anything is practice. And in this, Ralston is completely in agreement. It takes doing things, action, in other words, to develop the excellence in any endeavor. In fact, Ralston indicates three stages that are required to create it, mastery: practice, principle, and being. And this is the first place I want to draw out how his stages are essential to implementing any other aspect of this work. If we don't understand how principles work, then we'll continue to remain in the conceptual and theoretical domain and not impact our direct experience. And as mentioned before, without direct experience, we simply cannot attain a mastery. We can't even get on the road to it. Now, everyone knows and accepts that practice is the place that we need to start. We need to repeatedly engage in actions that will help us to be effective in some way. As runners, we understand this intuitively. You have to run to get better at running. In fact, one of the things that draws so many people to running is that the distinguishing characteristics of getting better at running are so simple and essential. But what this can cause folks to overlook is that simply practice ain't enough. As runners gain more experience, they begin to realize that there are a number of other key skills and strengths that they need to develop in order to continue to improve in their running. However, this realization usually starts the athlete down the road of other skills that they can then practice.
What I found really insightful about Ralston's approach is that he argues that we need to begin to consider the crucial principles that lie behind any skill or practice that need to be considered in order and experienced directly. In essence, we need to go beyond practice to the principles that practice is using to create or allow the skill or attribute to flourish. Now, you may be scratching your head wondering what the hell I'm talking about. I think perhaps that it's really useful to consider a principle that might make this idea more tangible. Ralston, likely because he's a martial artist, uses the principles of gravity and honor. While both these are really well considered and unpacked in the text, I think the runners might benefit more from something closer to our area of interest, endurance. So what is endurance in principle? It's the ability to keep doing something difficult, painful, or unpleasant for a long period of time. It's a basic definition. Using Ralston's stage model, we can start with practice. We train in such a way that we encourage some level of pain and difficulty and unpleasantness from time to time. We all intuitively get this. But when we move to the next stage of beginning to understand the principle of endurance, there are a myriad of paths that can unfold. Where endurance can seem pretty self-explanatory, the principle of endurance has the opportunity to open up with our working with it directly. It can develop significant nuance and insight when we allow the principle to permeate our whole life experience. For example, is endurance only a specific principle in running? Should we only practice enduring under the conditions of training? Or can we develop a keener insight of endurance when we consider where endurance benefits us in our work life and in our family life? Are there significant learning experiences available in simply recognizing where in our life we already practice endurance? For example, in the dentist chair, on a long international flight, in an uncomfortable conversation with a loved one? Are these not examples of direct experience with the concept of enduring? If so, can we use these insights to practice enduring in unique ways in our training? I mean, if nothing else, we certainly can begin to recognize the areas of our life where we need to work on enduring and bring those experiences forward in training. It seems pretty standard. Or if we sense that we're pretty adept at enduring in some mundane or domestic situations, maybe we can realize that we have a capacity and capability to endure more in our running. It seems pretty basic, but I don't think it was obvious. At least it wasn't to me until Ralston was pointing it out. And this isn't even unpacking the areas of endurance that are highly specific to training and racing. There are important aspects of endurance revolving around the unique physical kinds of suffering that various training sessions and types require. I think we can consider resilience and mental fortitude as essential aspects of enduring. For example, we recognize that the endurance required in a single hard mile effort is very different from the kind of pain associated with the marathon effort. And also, we can recognize that the kind of mental tenacity, resilience, and endurance required in each of those two different efforts is drastically different. Both are very hard. Both are very difficult. Both require enduring. But it's a different type of endurance, a different kind of enduring. By contemplating the principle of endurance in these unique situations, I think we can develop a better understanding of endurance as a principle and directly experience the suffering and pain in such a way that enduring becomes highly variable. This variability expands the principle by direct experience. And then we begin to become endurers. And this is the third stage of mastery, being a principle. Having explored the principle in a variety of contexts and venues, we directly experience the act of enduring repeatedly. We now are practicing the principle, not merely doing a specific session, not merely during a specific session or having a challenging conversation. We are being the principle of endurance in action. And as we do this repeatedly with intention, we become endurers. And the more variety of direct enduring experiences that we have, the more mastery of endurance we exhibit. We're on the road to mastery. Now, I know in some ways this might seem naive or facile or plainly obvious, but I don't think so. I think this is something that's hiding in plain sight. And what Ralston is doing, as he does in so much of The Art of Mastery, is bringing to our attention the fairly obvious. the In Plain Sight, and also many of the preconceived concepts, habits, and mindsets that we bring forward that aren't doing us any good, and that certainly aren't allowing us to perceive any situation accurately or correctly. And this is just one principle that I pulled up from what I consider a principle of a master runner would need to exhibit. And there are many others. For example, principles of adaptability or energy usage, feeling the body, of a mind-body coherence, the variety of principles of relationship that are essential to running. For example, relationship to weather, relationship to the course, relationship to time, to goals, to the ground, to competition. Rostin goes very deep and wide on the varieties of principles that he recommends one consider, both in general as human bodies acting in space-time, and specifically to what he calls effective interaction with whatever we're experiencing. For example, the seventh chapter of the book, he considers the following in short paragraphs that pretty much are worth the price of admission to the rigorous, fluid mind that he's sharing with us. These are listening, following, joining, complementing, leading, cutting, borrowing, changing. These may not seem like concepts or principles that would be worth considering. But if you'll just take a peek at the book and read through them, I think you'll see pretty quickly that what he's talking about is very deep and very wide. Now, I am deeply interested in exploring more principles that are specific to running as well. So as I watch for attributes I see in excellent runners or the skills and competencies that are missing in myself or the athletes that I work with, I feel like I can discover a whole plethora of intriguing ideas for growth and reflection. And I've only covered a small portion of the third chapter of this book. Just to be sure I give as wide a purview of the aspects around mastery as this book unfolds, I'll quickly summarize a few other core concepts that are highly useful in considering and implementing. One key area of insistence that Ralston hammers home is developing the essential skill of aligning perception with reality. His terminology for this is transforming your perceptive experience. Again, as I mentioned earlier, Ralston doesn't track down punny trails around what reality might be. He simply asks the reader to understand that they may not be seeing reality as it needs to be perceived in order to be effective at any action, or any action required for mastery. To unpack the idea of transforming perceptive experience, he asks us to consider distinctions. We laughed in the book club about the actual definition he gives for a distinction. I quote, "To be clear, a distinction is whatever your experience in any way, anything that is experienced or perceived, an object, a thought, an image, a relationship, a dimension, a feeling, emotion, numbers, word, ideas, space, anything experienced in any way on any level constitutes a distinction." That's from page 79. Okay, then. Everything we sense or experience is a distinction. I'm going to go back to Ralston. Quote, "Since distinctions make up your entire perceived experience, including mind, emotion, and internal states, then mastery demands that whatever distinctions are needed for effective action be known." End quote. Okay. So since I sense and experience things, it's crucial that I determine the distinctions that matter to my running. And Ralston, one more time to finish up the thought on distinction. Quote, "Because your actions relate to your experience must be capable of relating effectively to what's occurring. What makes this possible is making the right distinctions." End quote. So in my terminology, you can only know what to work on by knowing what really matters. And what really matters is making the right distinctions. Are you following? Let me just try to summarize this another way. And I think this is really important. We perceive reality through our senses. And these perceptions, what he calls distinctions, influence not only what I perceive, but what I need to do to get better at any activity, running in our case. So it really behooves me to perceive effectively and to refine my perceptions around the skills necessary for performing well. Now, what comes next is an entire chapter of unpacking these distinctions in a variety of categories. His categories are objective qualities, so things you might consider like weight, shape, design, substance. Space qualities like three-dimensional awareness, distance, spatial geometry. Process qualities like movement, direction, relational response. force qualities like balance and power and timing. He also covers what he also calls non-objective qualities like perception, interpretation, strategy, state, and impulse. You might be swimming in confusion right now. If you are, it's how most of us felt when we were reading Art of Mastery. We try to discuss the concepts, but because each one contains so much depth and requires an open mind willing to consider how much we operate on autopilot or in a default mode of experiential awareness, it became pretty difficult. Now, Ralston requires that you go there to attempt to work effectively with what shows up when we're in our bodies, mediating our day-to-day experience. And this isn't even actually mastery. In his opinion, mastery is perceiving and making the right distinctions every goddamn time. And that's a lot. But I think it's worth it. Why? Well, let me read to you how he summarizes these distinctions in a short outline form. And humor me, please. I think you'll be surprised at the practicality and depth of these. Again, I just went through a quote, you know, a quote where he described distinctions. And then I talked about basically, really, really quickly about these objective qualities and non-objective qualities. But what follows here is a short outline of these distinctions in a way that comes so pithy, so straight to the point, so useful, that I hope you'll sense how powerful this book can be. So he provides a short outline of five objective distinctions. Number one, keep a feeling connection with weight, shape, design, and substance of any object. Two, stay constantly immersed in the three-dimensional awareness. Feel the changes in distance and spatial relation. Three, know the meaning of each stage of an occurring process and relate appropriately. Stay unified and balanced to maximize applying a force and so manage all influencing forces. And five, know when to act and know when to wait. Aren't those really practical? I mean, each one of these takes those more esoteric or difficult to understand concepts around objective distinctions. He basically just says, take these steps. Number one, get a feeling connection. Number two, constantly immersed in your three-dimensional awareness, feeling the changes. In this case, it might be wind for runners or spatial relation, how close people are to you, how many people are there, how far away the hill is. Knowing the meaning of each stage of an occurring process, like where you are in the context of a race or in a workout. Are you on the hard part? Are you on the easy part? Are you relating effectively to that? Are you relating appropriately to that? Staying unified and balanced to maximize applying of force. This is just so you know ground contact appropriately, that you're using your heart rate efforts or your paces effectively so you can manage all the other influencing forces that are at play, running uphill, running downhill, running against other people, running by yourself, and then know when to act and when to wait. I mean, these five things are really, really powerful. And now let me share with you the short outline of the seven non-objective components that he describes. These are even better. Number one, stay open to your errors in perceptions. Number two, interpretation should accurately represent what's there and not be weighed down with personal stuff. Master your state of three, master your state of mind and create the best state for the circumstance. Four, keep all predictive patterns up to date and relevant and be alert to any possible changes. Five, never make a strategy a master over the objective. The strategy should always serve the objective and change the moment it doesn't. Six, wed all impulses to the current event and allow your impulses to be creative. And seven, develop the refined and accurate feeling sense of any other's experience in the moment. Now, for me, these lists just cut right to the quick of what the perceptive experience requires if I'm really paying attention. And in a way, it's like a cheat sheet for how I should be relating to what's going on around me when I'm taking effective action. So if that doesn't get you curious and excited to read the book, there's still much more in The Art of Mastery that can be unpacked and worked on for many, many years. For example, just to review a few other key points in case you're interested. Now, these I take directly from one of the Endorphin Book Club participants who shared her personal highlights. So these are in her words. One, taking responsibility. Mastery begins by clearly defining your overall purpose and objectives and taking ownership of your thoughts, actions, and learning. This requires a commitment to personal transformation and consistent, focused engagement. I mean, this is just super powerful. You begin to step into the idea of mastery by taking responsibility, understanding distinctions, understanding that everything that happens to you is something that you need to be responsible for. And it requires that you be committed to personal transformation. Like, it's, you have to take this shit seriously. You have to be all the way the fuck in. You have to get after it. Number two, and I already discussed this one, it's aligning reality with perception. In her words, mastering your craft involves ensuring that your experience is aligned with reality rather than being distorted by your subjective interpretations. Develop a fine, refined sensitivity to enhance your understanding and interaction with your surroundings. This involves letting go of preconceived notions, assumptions, false beliefs, and other personal baggage that clouds your perceptions. And you know, just go through refining your self-experience, focusing on process over outcome, being the principle. I talked about that a good bit. So I'm not sure, this is the first time I've done a book review. And again, as I mentioned repeatedly, this book is pretty challenging to get to all of the things that could be covered. If you're still with me, then I hope you'll take a gander at the book and take a chance to read it. And I think you're going to get a whole lot out of it. I mean, honestly, somehow, even after doing this entire episode, I feel like I haven't done justice to the depth and the insight that I've already gleaned and what I believe I'll continue to glean from The Art of Mastery. I hope this will encourage you to consider picking the book up, beginning to implement aspects of it into your training and racing. I mean, it's an immense book, not in the number of pages, but in the depth of wisdom and practical applications. And to end, what I'd like to do is to read you the conclusion of the book. And I'll just simply read this here and allow you to contemplate it. And we'll just go out with this. Cutting up an ox. One of Shang Tzu's ancient stories points to some of the principles and certainly the sensibilities involved in our search for mastery and effortless effectiveness. The following poetic rendering, as gathered by Thomas Merton in his book, The Way of Shang Tzu, speaks to mastery. Prince Wen Hui's cook was cutting up an ox. Out went a hand, down went a shoulder. He planted a foot, he pressed with a knee. The ox fell apart with a whisper. The bright cleaver murmured like a gentle wind. Rhythm. Timing. Like a sacred dance. Like the mulberry grove. Like ancient harmonies. Good work, the prince exclaimed. Your method is faultless. Method, said the cook, lying aside his cleaver. What I follow is Tao beyond all methods. When I first began to cut up an oxen, I would see before me the whole ox, all in one mass. After 3 years, I no longer saw this mass. I saw the distinctions. But now, I see nothing with my eye. The whole being apprehends. My senses are idle. The spirit, free to work without plan, follows its own instinct, guided by natural line. By the secret opening, the hidden space, my cleaver finds its own way. I cut through no joint, chop no bone. A good cook needs a chopper. Once a year, he cuts. A poor cook needs a new one. Once a month, he hacks. I have used this same cleaver 19 years. It has cut up 1,000 oxen. Its edge is as keen as if newly sharpened. There are spaces in the joints. The blade is thin and keen. When this thinness finds that space, there is all the room you need. It goes like a breeze. Hence, I have this cleaver 19 years as if it is newly sharpened. True, there are sometimes tough joints, but I feel them coming. I slow down. I watch closely, hold back, barely move the blade. And whoom, the part falls away, landing like a clod of earth. Then I withdraw the blade. I stand still and let the joy of the work sink in. I clean the blade and I put it away. Prince Han Hui said, "This is it. My cook has shown me how I ought to live my own life." Now, cutting up an oxen gives a beautiful sense of what it might be like to be a master. Of course, what is missing is the amount of work it took for him to get there. Yet the joy mastery brings to even such simple work shows it provides a life experience that's worth attaining. the journey itself should be life-changing experience. Although there's a lot of work involved, it can be fun and deeply satisfying. As I said, this book contains a lot of material, doesn't it? I understand that much of it won't be understood at first. It will take a strong will, lots of contemplation, investigation, experimentation, training, and more to get it all. As you begin to grasp and experience each point in the book, you will still have to take it into action and apply it to mastering your field. Sounds like a huge job, doesn't it? Remember that this is about you attaining mastery. Perhaps the reason so few master anything is because of the work and the challenges involved. But if you're excited about the adventure, even the work can be fun. Also, you will learn far more than you imagine and undergo an exciting transformation. And that's the best part, is that it will be real and not just a fantasy. Study the material, apply it to your field, and have fun. And that's the conclusion of The Art of Mastery. Thank you for joining me in this book review. It'd be great to hear how you feel it went, if you enjoyed it. Again, challenging book, but one I'll be going back to time and time again. Again, my friends, Godspeed. Godspeed. Until next time.